All right, welcome back, everyone. Parshas Matos Maaseh, Tavshin Ayin Tes, Shabbos Chazak. I apologize for not being able to have the Chabur in person tonight. Unfortunately, I was returning home from a business trip, and I was delayed. But Baruch Hashem, able to record it and send it out over the WhatsApp. And, you know, Chas V'Shalom, we go a week without Torah. So, Bez Hashem, this will hopefully next week back to the normal schedule with having the Chabur in person Thursday nights at BTU. So, again, Matas Maaseh, Tav Shinayin Tes, Shabbos Chazak. It's actually the first double Parsha of this year, amazingly, in Tav Shinayin Tes. It's been a phenomenal year for a Parsha Chabur because we've had the bandwidth to focus on each Parsha individually. But this week, finally, we have a double Parsha. But it's all good because here in Chutz La'aretz, via the double Parsha, we catch up and are finally reunited with our brothers in Eretz Yisrael. Apropos, just a few days before Tisha B'Av, to have that sign of Achdus to connect in the Parshios with our brothers in Eretz Yisrael. Something to think about for sure, but Eretz Yisrael has been a Parsha ahead of us since Pesach. So now to be on the same laning schedule, I know the people who listen to the Chabura over there now don't need to be a week behind anymore. So also just a quick note on today, some historical context. Tonight is Rosh Chodesh Av, Menachem Av. And the Torah quotes the Bahag and Or Chaim, Simen Tavkuf Pei, Hilchos Tanios, that a list of several days that historically many are knowing to fast, and one of them is Rosh Chodesh Av. But fascinating because it gives license to fast on Rosh Chodesh, which is typically a no-no. Typically, there's a mitzvah just for the opposite, to eat on Rosh Chodesh. But the exception is today. So why today? Because today, Aleph of Meis Aaron HaKohen. It's the yahrzeit of Aaron, the Oiv Shalom V'Odev Shalom, Oiv Esabrios Mekarvin LaTorah. His death was a precursor to the whole month. As the Gemara says, Mishenichnas of Mimatin Besimcha. So therefore, we make an exception, and we made it mutter, and even suggested by many to fast today on Rosh Chodesh Av. So for us at least, many of whom I'm presuming are not fasting today, but at the least to remember, the second base of Migdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. So even if we're not fasting today, to have that solemn mindset of what it means to have lost the pillar of Shalom, the pillar of Avos Yisrael, the remedy, the antidote to all the ills of this month, and that's Aaron HaKohen. And to try and learn a lesson from his life, right? Hashem is subtly giving us the refuah before the Makkah. Aaron HaKohen is the refuah before Chodesh Av, represented by Sina. And so to show us the paramount importance of Shalom and Avos Yisrael as a cure to all the terrible and tragic ills of Churban and Gullus. So something to keep in mind, to keep at the forefront of our minds as we enter this month of again, another year waiting for Mashiach to come. But all right, let's get into the Parsha, a quick summary like we always do. The Parsha begins with Halachos of Nedarim and Hataras Nedarim, right? Our Chiyuv and our Achrayus to live up to the words that come out of our mouths. And if we can't, who can annul it for various people? All those details are in this Parsha, and we'll get into that. We then discuss the actual war of revenge, Nikom, Nikmas B'nai Yisrael against Midian, for what they did to entice the Jewish men, right? 12,000 men, 1,000 per Shevet, led by Pinchas, waged this war, and the Pasuk tells us that all adult men from Midian were killed, along with Bilam, and Midian's 5 kings, and the women and children and the spoils were brought back to the Machane. And Moshe was upset about this, that the women were spared, because the women, they were the primary culprits here, right? Hein heina hayu livnei Yisrael bidvar Bilam. They were the ones who did the seduction. So Klal Yisrael, they killed the women too, the ones that were old enough to have been participants, and they only left the children alive, including the young girls who were not involved. The Pasuk then describes how they were mitar themselves from this war, since they were all Tamei Mace, which was new. In previous wars, no one had, they had avoided this until now. And there's a whole Arichus as to how they divvied up the spoils and koshered the kalim of the Midianim for their own use. So why does the question is, why does the Torah devote 20 plus psukim to how many cows and donkeys they plundered? Why is it important information for us in such detail? So the Mefarshim discussed this. The Ramban says it was a nace, that no animals, none of the spoils died. So the Torah gives the exact inventory to demonstrate that nace. Others, including Rav Zilberstein and Alena Lishabeach, say that this arichus and the tremendous real estate given to this topic is to emphasize that Klal Yisrael gave so much of the spoils to the Kohanim and the Levim, right? That the resentment from Parshas Korach against the Kohuna and Shevet Levi had been totally eradicated from the minds of Klal Yisrael. So these many psukim are demonstrating that success to us, right? It's a praise, it's a shevach to Klal Yisrael that they had rectified that shortcoming. And also, to demonstrate that victory in battle, the victory against Midian, and thereby the spoils of battle, comes just as much from the Ruchniyah side of the equation, represented by the Kohanim and Levim, just as much so as the warrior is actually doing the fighting. So, you know, take that what you may, politics aside per today's world. But as a final note to the post-war debriefing and inventory, Klal Yisrael realizes that not one Jew had died in this war, amazingly. Velo nifgad mimenu ish. And when they realized this, the Anshei Asava donated the gold that was plundered to the Mishkan as Hakaras HaTov to Hashem. The Parsha then turns to the story of Reuven and Gad, right? They owned lots of cattle, and they wanted to stay in Eiver HaYarden, in the former lands of Sichon and Og, where there was plenty of grazing land. And Moshe gives them Musar for this. Hachechem yavola milchama v'atem teishu po. He gives them Musar, right? You want to get off easy? So they respond that they'll lead the war into Eretz Yisrael, but they'll leave their flocks and their families behind in Eiver HaYarden. And when the conquest is finished and everything is divvied up, they'll go back to settle there. To which Moshe agrees, and at this point, Chatzi Shevet Menashe gets involved in the arrangement as well. That's Matos. Right, the Torah then moves into Parshas Maaseh, where we review the 42 encampments, how they got from Mitzrayim to where they are now, primed to enter Eretz Yisrael, and we'll discuss that in detail. The Psukim then discuss the borders of Eretz Yisrael, how it was all divided up, and we discuss the 48 cities that will be given to the Levim, 42 for their own living, plus 6 Ari Miklat, where unintentional murderers can flee to, and they can stay there safe from the Goel Hadam, the relatives of the person they killed. And the Pasuk says that they stay there till the Kohen Gadol dies. And we then discuss the epilogue to the Benos Tzlafchad story from last week. We've discussed this already a little bit, but how they needed to marry their cousins so the Nachla wouldn't be lost from their Shevet, like it would be if they married men from other Shvatim, and then the kids inherited that land, and therefore their Shevet would lose the land. So the fix was that they had to marry their cousins. And with that, we finish Sefer Bamidbar. And when you think about it, we finish really the main storyline of the Torah, since Dvarim, Mishneh Torah, is mainly a review, Moshe Rabbeinu's final speech to Klal Yisrael before his death. So with that, really at the end of Parshas Maaseh, we finish the storyline of Klal Yisrael's travels and travails in the Midbar, and thereby we can genuinely say, Besimcha, Chazak, Chazak, V'nis Chazek, because this really, truly is kind of the end of the story of the Torah. So let's dive right in and see what deeper Yesodos of Chizuk we can glean. All right, so the Parsha begins with a discussion of Nedarim and Shavuos. Ish ki yidor neder, right? He takes something upon himself. The halacha is, as we all know, he has to keep his word. Lo yachel dvaro k'chol ha'yotzei mipiv yaseh. Whatever comes out of his mouth, he has to keep it, and he can't violate it without a proper hataras nedarim. So on this halacha, Rabbi Nosson Mibreslev has a whole arichus about this in Likutei Halachos. Number one, he connects the parasha of Nedarim to Pinchas, in that Bilam and Balak represented Churban and Bein Hamitzarim, apropos for this time of the year, versus Pinchas and the Moadim represented Tikkun to that Inyan of Churban, and so to Nedarim represented Tikkun to the Inyan of Churban, because with our mouths we have unbelievable potential. We can mamish create new Torah, and that power intrinsically has the ability to overcome Churban and Bein Hamitzarim. What does that mean? Rabbi Nosson always speaks in very, very lofty terminology, but to bring it back down to earth a little bit, what we see from the concept in the Nedarim of a person taking a neder or a shavu on himself is very simple. Just, you know, if you think about it, I have no commandment to fast today. Right? We talked about Rosh Chodesh Av, that some have a minute to fast today. I have no tzivoy to fast today. But once I take a neder that I'm going to fast today, now I have a chi of doraisa to do so. Right? I can use my phone. Totally mutter. Well, some people would say it's not totally mutter, but let's assume that it's totally mutter. But once I take a neder to stay away from my phone, Now there's an issa deraisa hanging over my head if I pick up my phone. Right, I have no achrayas to give a certain amount of tzedakah. It's a nice thing, but I'm not mechuyev. But once I take a neder to give X dollars of tzedakah, it's ke'ilu, there's a pasuk in Chumash telling me personally, Jeff Thurm, to give that amount of tzedakah. Right, through our korach hadibor, we can, and we are, constantly creating new aspects, new psukim, mamish, in Torah. And they're 100% binding. Just think about it for a second, the magnitude of that. Rabbi Nosson expands on this. And this is why the concept in the Darim is really very useful for combating the Yetzer Hara, right? If I have a taiva for something that really I shouldn't be indulging in, what's stopping me from going there? What's stopping from venturing down that road? Maybe there's a broad isser in the Torah against it, but maybe there isn't. And like we discussed a couple weeks ago by Bilam, something can very often be mutter, but still it's flagrantly against the Ratzon Hashem. So what's stopping me from venturing down that path in my own life? Ah, but if I take a neder on top of all that, to stay away from these things, it's ke'ilu, I've created a personal chiyuv for me to guard against that particular yesod. And that, for some people, can help them get over the hump of temptation to do a particular avera that they happen to be struggling with. And because our words carry so much power, so much potential to create and destroy beyond what we may realize, we have to be careful with them, right? We have to make sure that they're spoken and chosen properly, to make sure that it comes out of our mouths as we intended to, and chas v'sholom, to never be just, you know, diarrhea of the mouth. That's why Rashi points out the Torah introduces the Parsha Nedarim to us with the words zeh hadavar, as opposed to the typical terminology for when Hashem is teaching something new to Moshe and Klal Yisrael, which is ko amar Hashem. Why? Because Zeh HaDavar demonstrates Moshe's clarity of these halachos. Zeh HaDavar, clear, as opposed to other Nevi'im, right? Where other Nevi'im, it's usually a less clear lashon, right? Zeh HaDavar is a lashon that the halacha was crystal clear to Moshe, but it's only used by Nedarim and Shchutei Chutz. That's it. Those are the only two places where that Lashon Zeh HaDavar is used in the Torah. Right? Everywhere else, it's Ko Amar Hashem, like a term of lesser clarity. So why is that? Why is Zeh HaDavar used by Nedarim? Very, very simple. Because our words and the immense Koach HaDibor that accompany our words demand that level of clarity. Our words demand a level of precision, like a surgeon's knife. That's how we should use our words. Zeh HaDavar, completely sober, 100% clear, and focused intently on what comes out of our mouths. And as we mentioned a few weeks ago in Chukas, one of the Pshatim, what Moshe did wrong by the Memeriva is that he didn't calculate his words carefully. And he said, Notzi lachem mayim, we, meaning Ki'ilu Aaron and I, Moshe Rabbeinu, will draw water out for you from the rock. Now, he clearly meant Hashem will draw out water from the rock. He clearly meant Yotzi lachem mayim. Moshe never thought that he was a god. But nonetheless, Moshe was careless with his phrasing a little bit, and that was his downfall, according to one pshat by the Memeriva. And it cost him entry into Eretz Yisrael. So, you know, I'm not telling anyone to get involved in Nedarim and Shavuos. In fact, the Mefarshim warn us very strongly to stay away from Nedarim and Shavuos, because it can be harmful to put that kind of extra yoke over a person, you know, should they be nichshol anyway. The consequences, you know, of being nichshol in a neder can be, you know, even more dire. So certainly not to go down that path, but I do want to underscore the koach hadibur that we all have for good or for bad, right? The biggest weapon Hashem has given each and every one of us is our mouths. So Amir Tashem, we can use it properly to create and to build huge constructs of bracha v'atzlacha for ourselves and our families, and chas v'shalom to ever use our mouths to destroy. That's number one. So really the last act of Moshe Rabbeinu that he's commanded to do before he's destined to die is to wipe out Midian, right? This war with the Midianim, a war of revenge for what they did to Klal Yisrael, Nikom, Nikmas Bnei Yisrael Me'esa Midianim, enticing the men to sin with Znus and Avodah Zarah, causing 24,000 deaths. And then Moshe will die. Achar Te'aseif Alamecha. So Klal Yisrael knew this. Moshe himself knew this, that this was his last rodeo. But nevertheless, they mustered up the tremendous strength and energy to do the Ratzon Hashem, and they indeed fought Midian without delay, knowing full well what that kiyum, that mitzvah of nekama, would facilitate right after. And that's a lesson in and of itself, right? Doing the Ratzon Hashem, no matter the cost. We can all learn a tremendous amount just from that. But something interesting here, it's not so black and white. we see something interesting. The tzivui was for Moshe Rabbeinu himself to lead Klal Yisrael into battle against Midian, right? Nikom Nikmas, you, Moshe, personally, take revenge for Klal Yisrael against Midian. But is that what he does? Not at all, right? He says, as Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen Latzava, he sends Pinchas to lead them in his place. So he just praised Moshe for doing what Hashem told him to do, despite the cost, despite it was going to cost him his life. But he didn't do exactly what Hashem told him to do. He sent a shliach for him to do it. So number one, how could he do that? Right? How can Moshe call an audible on the Ratzon Hashem? But moreover, even more strange, I would say, is why doesn't Hashem call him out on this, right? You think there'd be some admonishment, some mussar. I clearly told you to do this motion, not Pinchas, but nothing. There's no mention of this in the Pesukim. Hashem was seemingly 100% maskim to this, to Moshe calling it audible on the pshat and the pasuk. So clearly there's something deeper going on here, beneath the layers of pasuk pshat. So we need to understand what that is. So this question is asked and answered by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz in Sichos Musar. And the answer is, how come Moshe didn't do it himself? He says, because of Hakaras HaTov, right? Because when he fled Mitzrayim after killing the Mitzri, he lived by Yisro, and Yisro was the Kohen Midian. So the people of Midian took Moshe in and cared for him during that time he was in exile, until he first met Hashem by the Sneh and returned to Mitzrayim. So did this act of war need to be done? Absolutely. Nikom Nikmas B'nai Yisrael. They had to go to war against Midian. But did it need to be done by Moshe himself? No. That he tainted wouldn't be proper. That would be a violation of Hakaras HaTov. That would be a flagrant display of ingratitude towards the people who helped him once upon a time. So you know, Pinchas, you know, this is not my place. This is not my place. You take my spot here at the front line, says the Sichos Musar. And this isn't surprising, because we all know that Hakaras HaTov was a strong midah of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? He didn't perform the first few makos because of dafka this. The water saved him when he was a baby, and the ground covered up the Mitzri for him when he killed the Mitzri. So how could he hit the water? How could he hit the ground for the makos? So Aaron did it for him, right? Moshe had a spectacular, unparalleled midah of Hakaras HaTov. But Rav Chaim Shmulevitz asks a follow-up question on this, and that's very simply, who cares? Who cares? Did Hashem not know that Midian took Moshe in? Did Hashem not consider that Moshe leading this war might tinge of ingratitude? Of course Hashem did. Of course he did. And nonetheless, he gave a direct tzivoy. Nikom nikmas b'nei Yisrael me'esa midyonim. Moshe, I know your history, and I am nonetheless commanding you, appointing you for this mission. So how can Moshe go against that? Is Moshe now frumer than Hashem, chas v'shalom, that he tainted Hakaras HaTov when Hashem himself didn't tain Hakaras HaTov? It's an obvious question. Hashem wasn't oblivious to this, he knew. And to even strengthen the kasha, it's dafka this yesod, right? Hashem telling mankind A, but then mankind injecting their own logic to arrive at a different conclusion. You know, how many Jews have fallen off the derech and are no longer Shomer Torah mitzvos? Dafka because they employed the same logic that Moshe does here, right? Hashem, I know you told me not to drive on Shabbos, but the shul is very far and it's hot outside. So I'm going to change this. I'm going to modify things for you to enhance the Torah, to strengthen the shul attendance. And look what happened to those Jews. Nebuch, how many of their kids, you know, proceeded sadly to intermarry and now completely are lost. So how is this any different than Hashem? I know you told me to do this, but Midian was very hospitable to me, so I'll modify the Torah a little bit and let Pinchas go ahead in my place. How is that any different? How is it any different? You know, this thing that Moshe is employing over here is very dangerous. You know, this is how a lot of people go off the derech. And like I said, where is Hashem criticizing him? Calling Moshe out on this shortcoming to say something like, you know, Avram Avinu didn't question me when I said Shech Yitzchak, and so too you shouldn't be questioning me either. Trust me, I know what I'm doing here. Where's the Pasuk saying that? That Pasuk is nowhere to be found. So it's very, very strange. So clearly we're missing something here. Just you know, I just want to strengthen the kasha as much as possible before we get to the teretz. So answers the Sichos Mutzar an amazing thing. He says the Torah is using this episode to teach us a lesson about Hakaras HaTov, about gratitude, what it truly is. What is it? And that's as follows. Now, Hakaras HaTov, the midah of gratitude, is so powerful, so overarching, that by its very nature, it's baked into all of Torah, into all of Halacha. In other words, Hakaras HaTov is unique. It is such common sense that when Hashem tells me A, but A violates Hakaras HaTov, The Torah is telling me that Eichanami, Hashem meant be. That's what the Sichas Moser says. And we learned this from Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem says, you destroy Midian, but I can't destroy Midian. I have a Karas HaTov to them. And a Karas HaTov is by nature baked into every nook and cranny of Halacha. It's part of the Torah's very fabric. So when I, Moshe Rabbeinu, put on my Karas HaTov glasses, as I always do, it must be that Hashem meant appoint a shliach. So Pinchas, you go. And to this, we see in the Pesukim, Hashem was maskim. Hashem approves. No criticism whatsoever. Ki'ilu Hashem said, Eichanami, Hakaras HaTov is indeed baked in. So you, Moshe Rabbeinu, understood correctly. When I said you take revenge on Midian, indeed that meant you, Moshe, you should handle it. And you handled it correctly within the scope of Hakaras HaTov, vis-a-vis your appointment of Pinchas to man the front. That's pshat according to Rav Chaim. And we see from here the incredible chashivas of a Karas HaTov, right? It's so obligatory, so overarching, that it can dictate the nature of halacha even when the Pashup Shat leans away from it, right? We learned this from Moshe Rabbeinu, who, like we mentioned earlier, clearly excelled at this in many different examples and circumstances. And if Hashem built the Torah in such a way, if Hashem himself abides by these rules, how much more so are we compelled to live our lives in the same fashion, right? To train ourselves to be grateful people, Hakaras HaTov Jews, to our parents, to our spouses, to our siblings, to our friends, to our children, to our co-workers, to anyone who's deserving of that midah, to anyone who has helped us get to where we are today, and of course, to Hashem himself. And if we actively live that kind of a life of constant appreciation for the good that has been so graciously bestowed on us, Mirtz Hashem, we should all be zochet to have that spigot of bracha never ever close, to always be a raging river of atzlacha and parnasa and simcha and nachas for us and our families. So amazing idea about Hakaras HaTov, how it works within the very fabric of Torah from the Sichas Musar. So number two, or number three rather, as part of the war with Midian, the Torah tells us the fate of the five kings of Midian themselves. V'yas Malchei Midian Haragu al Chalaleim as Evi, V'yas Rekem, V'yas Tzur, V'yas Chor, V'yas Reva, Chameshes Malchei Midian. Right, and they were all wiped out along with their people. So Rashi points out that Tzur was actually the main king of Midian. He was the most chashuv of them, but he's listed third on this list. Right, as Evi, V'yas Rekem, V'yas Tzur. Why? Because it was a genai to him. It's a disgrace for him that he fell to the bronze medal. Why? Because he allowed his own daughter, Cosby, to entice Zimri, the Nasi of Shimon, right? Cosby was the daughter of Tzur. And then eventually Pinchas famously killed them both. So because he let his daughter, disgrace herself, he fell down from being the most chashuv of the kings to number three on the list. So I saw in the Sefer Shiurei Das, from the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells, and he asked there, why should Tzur care that he was demoted in the Torah? Number one, he's dead. He's dead. And number two, he's not even Jewish. So we're punishing him post-mortem by giving him the bronze medal of the Malchei Midian as written in the Torah? Who cares? Who cares? And as such, you know, how do you explain this Rashi? You know, because Rashi is mashma that it is a punishment, like he would care. So he answers, the Rosh Yeshiva answers, the Shiurei Das answers, that from here we see a subtle reference to Olam Haba, to the Olam HaEmes in the Torah, right? That we all live on in some manner after death, both Risharim and Tzadikim, even if it's only on a spiritual plateau, but that existence, whatever it is, makes us subject to embarrassment and punishment even in the next world. It doesn't just stop when a person leaves this world. He says that even in the Olam HaEmes of Tzur, he is continually embarrassed by his demotion to third amongst the Malchei Midian until this day. On some level, wherever Tzur is, this is a punishment for him. So Alachas Kam V'chama for us, right? To remember that our actions also follow us well beyond this world, either to bring us Nachas and Simcha, or Lo Aleinu, they can bring us embarrassment and Tsar. So Mirtz Hashem, we can mold our lives to always be on the right side of the right side of that equation. So a small but nice yisod about Tzur Melech Midyan. And continuing on, the pasuk ends with the following historical note: V'yas Bilam ben Beor Hargu Becharif. Bilam was also killed by Klal Yisrael in this war with Midyan, but then in the debriefing, You know, Moshe sees that the army of Klal Yisrael had let the women live. And he objects to this, right? Right? These were the women who enticed the men of Klal Yisrael to sin with the Avodah Zarah of Peor, which resulted in a horrendous plague. 24,000 Jews were killed. So therefore, you need to kill all the women who are old enough to have participated in this seduction. And so it was, right? The interesting thing here is that for the first time, we learned something that we already knew. What's that? That this entrapment, the Benos Moav and Benos Midian incident, was the work of who? Who was behind this? Who was the puppet master here? It was Bilam. Bidvar Bilam limtsar mal b'Hashem. It was Bilam that got Klal Yisrael to betray Hashem. This was his plot, right? He couldn't curse Klal Yisrael, so he got them to destroy themselves by entrapping them with good-looking women and a whole ruse with the big sales in the marketplace. The interesting thing is that there's no mention of this whatsoever when it's actually happening, when we tell over the story in Parshas Balak, right? We know it to be true. We discussed it back in Balak, but that's only because we have the benefit of the rest of the Torah ahead of us, which we and Chazal have already learned. However, if you were sitting reading the Torah for the first time, this fact that it was Bilam behind all this is not learned when the story is actually recorded there in Parshas Balak. Right there, the Torah simply says, "Vayeshev Yisrael bashitim vayochel ha'am liznosel benos mav." The Torah mentions what happens, but no mention of the who, no mention of who was behind this, no mention of Bilam. This is not told over to us until here, until Parshas Matos, after they just killed Bilam. So the question is why? Why does the Torah hold back this fact, you know, the seemingly crucial detail, that, you know, it really is the glue that connects the stories of Balak and Pinchas? So why is it held back until now, until Parshas Matos? Just tell us then, as a continuation to the story of Balak and Bilam, that it was Bilam's last gasp attempt to get Klal Yisrael, and it very nearly worked in destroying them. Say it then. Why say it now? So I heard a phenomenal answer quoted in the name of Professor Nechama Leibowitz, and Baruch Hashem, I was able to track down the Sefer and have it here on the Mar Makomos, which will also be posted on the WhatsApp for those who follow along in the Mar Makomos. It's really a phenomenal, I found it an extremely powerful Musar idea that I think should speak to all of us in our daily lives, and that's as follows. When a Jew, when anyone for that matter, messes up, whether it be an actual Avera like Lashon Hara or Shmiras Einayim, or even more serious things like Avodah Zarah or Gneva or Znus, whatever it may be, or even if it's just bad midos like Atzlus, laziness, or Gaiva or Kas, you know, when you do an autopsy on that chait after the fact, there's always somebody else to blame. Yes, I yelled at my wife, that's true, but it's only because my boss got to me, you know, today. I got so riled up. So, you know, I was just angry. Yes, I was lazy and I missed Midian on Sunday morning, but it's only because my friends kept me up so late the night before and I just couldn't make it out of bed this morning. Yes, I spoke Lashon Hara, but it's only because, you know, my neighbor dragged me into the discussion as a favor to him because he was going through a tough time and he needed me to listen. So, you know, and these aren't cop-outs. You know, they're true. Very often we are indeed not the originators of our shortcomings. It does stem from someone else tripping us up. And so too here, Klal Yisrael messed up with the Benos Moav. They messed up in matters of Znus and Avodah Zarah, but it's only because Bilam tricked them, right? Be'etzim, it wasn't their fault. They didn't originate this chait. They certainly didn't seek out these women. And we've discussed this before in this Chabur. That's why it was kind of a superficial thing. And that's all true. But says Professor Leibowitz, the Torah leaves this part out of the story, that Bilam was the source of this whole thing, not to be told over until later, until our Parsha, Matos. Why? Why is it left out in Parshas Balak? It's to teach us that in the moment, we are responsible for ourselves, right? In the moment, there are always forces pulling us to places we shouldn't be. But if we choose to engage, if we choose to venture down that rabbit hole, then it's on us. And that's why Hashem empowered us with Bechira Chavshis, to make the right choices. So yes, Bilam started it, but Klal Yisrael had the opportunity to finish it, to say no and run away, and they didn't. And therefore, the Torah holds them accountable. Vayochel ha'am Liznos Elbinos Moav. No mention of Bilam whatsoever. Later, yes, in our parsha, we eventually find out the full picture of this story, that Bilam, you know, displayed tremendous rishus in his trickery to seduce Klal Yisrael, and as such, he pays the ultimate price, right? He was killed here in Parshas Matos for that rishus. And because he dies here, because he's killed, so the Torah relates why in postmortem. Because he was the puppeteer of this disaster. But in the moment, when it was actually occurring, two parshios ago, Vayochel Ha'om, not Vayochel Bilam, Vayochel Ha'om, Liznos Elbinos Moav. Right? Bilam's involvement is not at all relevant. Right? You mess up in life, it's on you. You do an Avera, even if someone else instigated it, even if you didn't seek it out, you do an Avera, you have no one to blame but yourself. Right? Your life choices are on you, no one else. You can't blame anyone else. And that's why Bilam is absent in the Peor story, as mentioned in Parshas Balak. It's an amazing lesson in personal responsibility that we should, you know, we would all do very well to embody, right? Hashem is constantly testing all of us. Life's not easy. It's not meant to be. There are always obstacles in our path, you know, tremendous temptations that come before us, not because we sought them out, because that's just how the world is. We can't control if the Bilams of our time are trying to ensnare us. But we can, and we do control if we fall victim to it, right? That's the nature of a nisayon. Without nisyonos, life would be pretty easy. But that's not our tafkid. Our tafkid is to look Bilam's challenge right in the eye and walk away. Because our lives, our responsibilities are on us, right? We are the drivers of our own lives. And therefore, Bilam is not relevant to our story. So Mirtz Hashem, we can embody this amazing lesson in personal strength and personal responsibility that we all genuinely, you know, need to adopt for ourselves, right? That's crucial to being the best Jews, the best Ovdei Hashem we can possibly be. And in that schus of taking charge of our own actions and, you know, always realizing that the blame and the responsibility falls on our shoulders, you know, Mirtz Hashem, we should see nothing but bracha v'atzlacha, nothing but brightness and warmth from Hashem in all of our endeavors. Next piece. So now we're at the end of Parshas Matos. The last inyan discussed here is the story of Reuven and Gad, right? Abdicating their rights in Eretz Yisrael in favor of the vast grazing lands available for them in Eiver HaYarden, in Transjordan, east of the Yarden, right? The former lands of Sichon and Og. And these Shvatim in particular, Reuven and Gad, had tremendous amounts of cattle and sheep and all sorts of flocks. The Pasuk says, Umikne Rav. So they made a cheshbon and decided this was the best thing for their parnasa, right? Because this was the ideal grazing land for flocks. So Moshe, as expected, was not too happy with this. Hachechem yavola milchamav yatem teishu po. Your brothers should fight wars with the Canaanim and you get to stay behind in tranquility. How is that fair? So Reuven and Gad were maskim. V'anachnu nechaleitz chushim lefnei b'nei Yisrael ad asher im havionum el mikamam. We'll lead the wars of conquering Eretz Yisrael. We'll be on the front lines. We'll do our fair share and then some to help our get our brothers settled in Eretz Yisrael. But then we'll return here to Eiver HaYarden. So, all right. So to this, Moshe and Hashem were okay with this arrangement. But what about the women and the children and all the flocks of Reuven and Gad? They had so many. Are they going to come also into Eretz Yisrael? So no, Reuven and Gad suggested Gidros. They had a suggestion, right? What'd they say? Pasuk says, Gidros tson nivne l'mikdenu po v'arim l'tapenu. We'll build barns and stables for our animals, and we'll build cities for our women and children. So they'll be set up here in Eiver HaYarden until we get back. And so it was. That's the story of Reuven and Gad. And at the end, we learn that Chatzi Shevet Menashe joined up with them. And Rashi says that Lemaisa, in fulfillment of this pledge, they actually didn't return home for 14 years, right? Seven of conquering Eretz Yisrael and seven to apportion it out. So many Mefarshim add a lot of meat to this story. There's a lot to be discussed here. So we'll just mention a couple of them. And, you know, obviously, as always, you know, I think a couple of good lessons that we could learn from this story that, you know, are very relevant even in our times, in Tafshinayin Tes. Number one, Rav Dessler in Michtav Melio explains that their motives were not really, you know, at Pashup Shot. You know, the Pashup Shot is they were focused on their Parnassa, but that's not entirely true, right? It's not like they saw Eiver HaYarden and all they saw was dollar bills. No, says Rav Dessler. He explains that they tina, you know, listen, it was Hashem who was mevarich us with all these animals. We didn't give them to ourselves. They were gifts from Hashem. So that being the case, our tafkid must be to raise the animals in the best way possible so that we can help all of Klal Yisrael, including our brothers in Eretz Yisrael, whether it be for food or to provide the entire nation with animals for the various karbanos, right? It's our tafkid to raise the fattest, healthiest, most prime flocks that we can possibly can. And where can we do that? Where's the best place in Mekayim, this tafkid that Hashem gave us? Here, in Eber HaYarden, because look at all this wonderful grazing land. This is where we should stay. So when you look at the story through those lenses, their request doesn't sound so bad anymore. And Moshe Rabbeinu, through Ruach HaKodesh, knew that they were right, that this was indeed their tafkid. So he agreed, provided that they help out on the military side, which they agreed to do. So Shalom Al Yisrael, says Rav Dessler. Rashi, however, uses a much more critical lens for this story. He points out that it wasn't all good. He points out that when Reuven and Gad are suggesting what to do to get their women and their animals settled before they leave, that, right, we said, the pasuk says, Gidros tzon nivne lebikneinu po. Right, first the animals are cared for, and then v'arim litapenu, homes for the family. So Moshe criticizes them that their priorities are backwards. Parnasa, Gidros tzon, before family, v'arim litapenu. How can you say that? Chasim hayu al memonim yoser mibneim uvnoseim. Shikdimu Bnu lachem, I'm sorry, shehikdimu miknehem letapam. Right? Their flocks, their parnasa, preceded their children. So when he responds, Moshe corrects them. The pasuk says, when Moshe responds to them, Bnu lachem arim letapchem ugderos letzonachem. Tend to your children and your families first, and then worry about your parnasa. So concludes Rashi, ha'ikr, ikr, v'ha'tofel, tofel. Right? Bnu lachem Tchila arim letapchem ve'acher kach gidros letzonachem. So we see that Reuben and Gad were overly fixated on money, on materialism, so much so that it found expression in their words and in their priorities, even in comparison to their own families. And because of this, the Medrash says v'chavu es memonam v'yashvulhem chutz me'eretz Yisrael. Because of their overfixation on money, which was the root cause of why shefrishu atzma minachem, they separated themselves from their brothers, right? This is clearly unlike the more optimistic approach that we just said in Rav Dessler. But because of that, in the times of the Churban, galu tchila mikol ha-shvatim. These shvatim, Reuven Gad and Chatzi Menashe, were sent into galus years prior to the rest of Klal Yisrael, who still lived in Eretz Yisrael proper at that time. So that's a couple points. A few other small points about distorted realities and confused priorities. The Kli Yakar highlights another flaw that's found here, namely that God spoke before Reuven. Right, the pasuk says Vayavo v'nei God uvnei Reuven vayomru el Moshe, which implies that God spoke first, even though Reuven was the Bechor. So why would God do that? Why would he speak before his older brother? Because the Kli Yakar says God was actually richer than Reuven. He actually had more flocks than Reuven did. So he felt like it was his place to speak first, right? God's sense of midos went by the wayside because of the misplaced sense of kavod and prestige that his parnasa afforded him, right? Ki kach teva ha'osher. This is the nature of a rich person. Shenosein rom lev levala v'osher hedyot kofetz birosh. Money can do terrible things to a person. It can completely distort reality, and we need to be on guard for that. The Chas HaShalom, it should give us a sense of prestige that isn't necessarily warranted. And lastly, Rav Schwab extends this theme to actually the last pasuk of Parshas Matos, right? The pasuk says that when Moshe was appointing or apportioning this land, Me'ever HaYarden, to the Bnei Menashe, V'yar ben Menashe halach ve'el kodes chavoseim v'yikros hen chavos yar. Yar ben Menashe captured a city and called it Chavos Yar. And so too, v'novach halach v'yilkot es knos v'yes b'noseha, v'yikro la novach b'shmo. Novach also captured his own city and named it Novach after himself. And Rashi comments that Chavos Yoyer, that name was Mekuyim, it lasted, but Novach lo niskayim, that city eventually changed its name to something other than Novach, not after its founder Novach. And Esav Schwab, why did Chavos Yoyer keep the name of its founder, but Novach dropped the founder's name a short period after? And says Rav Schwab, it's because Yar ben Menashe called the city Chavos Yair, meaning literally translated the township of, just to use a word we're familiar with, the township of Yair, which is historically accurate because he did indeed found that town. He was the founder of that town. Versus Novach, it wasn't called Chavos Novach, the township of Novach, or something like that. It was called Novach by himself. So Novach is mashma that he, Novach, Taka, is the city. Myself, my city, my possessions, my wealth, my kavod are all one and the same. They all represent who I am. So that attitude that my wealth is the sum total of who I am, that this city is me, Novach, that attitude is not Mekuyim. That's not a Torah value. And therefore, Novach did not last as the name of the town for very long. That legacy was and is always a fleeting thing. So to review many lessons here, number one, to always be on the lookout for the toxic side effects of money, how it can corrupt a person, it can give one a false sense of kavod and prestige and entitlement like we saw in the Kli Yakar. And ultimately, we see that it destroys a person's longevity and his legacy in this world, as we just saw from Rav Schwab. The lesson being that a person's great wealth can certainly be the greatest tool in one's avodas Hashem if he handles it with perspective, that the goal of wealth is to provide for our material needs and for the needs of others too, through tzedakah and so forth, but certainly wealth is not a means unto itself. But first and foremost, I want to go back, the stark lesson from Rashi's understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu's critique of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, and that is a family before Parnassa, right? They got it backwards. They said, Gidros Tzon Nivne L'Bneinu Pov Arim L'Tapenu, and then Moshe corrects them, Benu Lachem Arim L'Tapchem U'Gedoros L'Tzonechem. Flip the priorities, right? Family before Parnassa. That's the Yisod. Family before Parnassa. You know how many fathers and even mothers sacrifice learning with their kids, playing with their kids, listening to their kids in pursuit of parnassa. And instead, their kids are raised by a babysitter. And then the parents also sacrifice the weekends with their kids because they're tired or because that's their time to be social. It's a growing trend in our society. It's a growing tragedy in our society. And I think this is the reason so many kids, lo aleinu, fall off the derech, right? Benu lachem arim letapchem. Get that settled and get that to a good place. And then, ugederos letzonachem, as Moshe Rabbeinu says, then worry about your parnassa, right? There's a famous saying I heard that, nobody ever in the history of humanity has ever said on their deathbed that I wish I had spent more time in the office. So, if we do this, if we always embody this message and keep our priorities straight, family comes first, and then we should be zochet to the unending brachos of both, right? Benu lachem arim letapchem, healthy, happy, tight-knit families that are immersed in Kedusha, as well as the brachos of Ugderos Litzonachem, a very generous parnasa to not only support ourselves, but Bezer Hashem, others as well. All right, next. So being a double parsha, let's move over to, and I apologize, this is going to be a longer chabura because it's two parshios, so I have twice the material. So I'm trying as much to condense it, but I have two parshios worth of material, so it is just going to be by nature a longer chabura. So let's move over to Parshas Maaseh, which begins by the Torah explicitly outlining the 42 machnes, the 42 journeys of Klal Yisrael, all the way from the left Mitzrayim through the 40 years of the Midbar to where they stood right then, primed and ready to enter Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara explains that Moshe Rabbeinu kept a diary of everywhere Klal Yisrael went. Vayichto Moshe es motzoehem lemaseihem. That's him keeping the diary. And here Hashem told him to publish it as part of the Torah. Ve'elem maseihem lemotzoehem. That's the reason, that's the pshat in the pasuk, right? Vayichto Moshe es motzoehem lemaseihem. That's the fact that Moshe kept this journal. And then ve'elem maseihem lemotzoehem. Hashem says, publish it as part of the Torah. And that's what the beginning of Parshas Maaseh is all about. The question all the Mefarshim ask is, why was this important, right? Why do we need to know this, right? It's superfluous that they were here, and then they were there, and then they were here, and then they were there, and so forth, for Pasuk after Pasuk after Pasuk, for a good chunk of Parshas Maaseh, actually. What information is this conveying? We all know it's well documented. The Torah doesn't say one word more than necessary. So, how was this necessary? And that's what I want to explore. So many ideas on this. Rashi makes note of the fact that 42 stops in 40 years basically comes to one journey per year on average. So the Torah tells us this to demonstrate how Hashem had rachmim, he had rachmonis on them, right? To not overly burden them with travel. You know, as someone who just stepped off a plane about an hour ago, you know, I can certainly appreciate that, you know, but still, you know, then say they traveled to 42 places. Even if you want to say, all right, the pshat is that, you know, Hashem didn't make them travel so much. He had rachmim on them. He had rachmonis on them, that they didn't have to have overly burdensome travels in the desert. But just say, all right, they traveled to 42 places, and we can do the math, 42 places in 40 years. Why the need to list them out so deliberately? So Rashi's second pshat addresses this. He gives Moshel Amelech, a king who has a sick son, and they go all over the place, various doctors across the world, to try and get him better. So once they return, the son, Baruch Hashem, is doing much better. And the father reminisces about this journey, how it was all worth it. This doctor in Boston, and then this specialist in London, right? You know, this refuah in Kivros Atava, that tikkun in Makelos, how it was all necessary to get them to this stable, good place where they are today. And so to hear, Hashem lists out the masos to demonstrate the virtue of the journey, right? That everywhere they went had a purpose to build them up into the Jews they were today, finally ready to enter Eretz Yisrael. That's really the classic pshat that everyone says. But there are many others as well. You know, the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim says that if you look at the places, these 42 places on a map, I guess if you had a map from that time, you'd see that all these places were remote. They weren't near food or water or civilization. So the Torah lists them out to show the incredible miracles that needed to take place in order to sustain that, you know, huge magnitude of people in places that were so off the beaten path, right? They weren't exactly staying at the Hilton, right? So that's what the Rambam says. So the Masos are listed to show the greatness and the unbelievable chesed of Hashem. The Svarno takes it in the opposite direction. He says, Lehodia zechusam belechtam achara b'midbar beretz lo zrua. It's to demonstrate the greatness not of Hashem, but of Klal Yisrael, that they followed Hashem to all these remote places without food and water and civilization, because look how strong their emuna was. So this list, this, you know, nostalgic, you know, walk down memory lane, is to praise Klal Yisrael for taking the plunge in the first place and for how strong their emuna was, how strong their love for Hashem was, you know, as a lesson for all of us to learn from. You know, like we've said before, it's very easy. Sometimes you read Sefer Bamidbar and you see all these stories, one after another, parsha after parsha, of their shortcomings. And it's very easy to forget how great this generation was. It's too easy to think of the Dor Midbar as Rishoim and Misonanim and Meraglim and Korach and the Benos Moav and so forth. And so before we wrap up the Sefer, before we wrap up Parshas Maaseh, the Torah reminds us who these people really were, right? Before we finish Sefer Bamidbar, Hashem reminds us, Eila Maaseh B'nei Yisrael, Lahodiyah Zchusam B'lechtam Achra B'midbar Be'eretz Lo Zeruah. Despite what you may think after the last, you know, month of Parshios, these Jews were unbelievably chashiv, right? The biggest maminim of all time. That's the Svarno. The Orachayim HaKadosh and the Sfas Emes, from the Hasidic side of the spectrum, basically they echo Rashi to a certain extent, that at each of the 42 stops, and the accompanying difficulties encountered at all of those 42 stops, at each there was a tikkun in Ruchnius that occurred that was critical to build them into the people they became, right? We all know one of Hashem's holiest names is the 42-letter Shem Hashem. So you can suggest that connects to the 42 stops Klal Yisrael made between Mitzrayim and Eretz Yisrael, because at each stop, a necessary tikkun occurred to build them up and to maximize their relationship with Hashem for that time. So too with us, right? You know, there's a lesson to be learned here from Rashi and the Arachaim and the Sfas Emes, that, you know, our own lives are very often mountains and valleys, right? Alios and Yeridos, right? There are times that we feel like we're growing, good times, and there are times when we feel like we're sinking. But Hashem lists them all. Eile Maaseh B'nei Yisrael, the times when we're going up and the times when we're going down, to remind us that everywhere we may find ourselves in lives, whether it's in the base medrash, to mamish eretz lo zrua, from a construct of Torah and mitzvos to a dark place that's devoid of any kedusha seemingly, right? Everywhere. The good and the bad has been charted by Hashem for our benefit, right? As motzoihem l'maseihem, all of it is al pi Hashem. All of it. As motzoihem l'maseihem, al pi Hashem, right? Our path in life is completely al pi Hashem. So even in the dark places, to remind ourselves, Hashem put us here dafka in this place to learn something, you know, to see something, to accomplish something. That as hard as it may be right now where I am in my life, I'm meant to gain something from this experience, whether in gashmius or ruchnius, or in terms of my personality, or in terms of my perspective on life and my experiences. And that something, whatever it may be, is crucial to my eventual destination. Es motzoyhem l'maseyem al pi Hashem. To always remember that. So this should always, you know, give us a bit of chiyus and chizik, to never ever feel depressed or misyosh if we don't find ourselves in the place that ideally we'd want to be in our lives. Because it's not always about the destination, about the goal, right? Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't get to Eretz Yisrael. He didn't reach his quote-unquote goal, if you view Eretz Yisrael as Moshe's, you know, destined accomplishment. But that would be the wrong way to view it, because for Moshe, the journey, the Maseyim, was his accomplishment. And so too for us. Mirtz Hashem, you know, we all reach our destinations with Simcha and Bracha and Atzlacha, but to remember the journey there, in Hashem's eyes, is just as important, if not more so, right? That's the Or HaChaim and the Sfas Emes and really Rashi, you know, with subtle twists on this idea. So Mirtz Hashem, we can take Chizik in this, to always remember the inherent beauty in the journey of life, you know, wherever it is that Hashem may take us. And if we do that, genuinely, we should be zocha to have all of our tefillos answered, number one, always, and to have all of our personal goals be reached with only bracha and atzlacha and warmth from Hashem himself. Next idea. So at the end of Maaseh, you know, one of the last topics discussed in Sefer Bamidbar is the establishment of the Ari Miklat. Right, cities of refuge where people who killed Beshogeg unintentionally would go in order to escape the Agol Hadam, the relatives of the person they killed, or he killed, rather. And they served, it was a very practical purpose, right? You can say the Pashup Shat Ari Miklat served a very practical purpose. It was a safe haven, it was base. You know, think of it, they're on base, so they couldn't be touched. And as the Torah prescribes, there were six Ari Miklat where these Beshogeg murderers lived alongside the Leviim, who also lived there. And then the Leviim had another 42 cities that were exclusively for them. And these unintentional murderers only went free, only left, when the Kohen Gadol, the current one rather, at the time of their verdict, when he died, and not sooner. So a side note to this, before we jump into Ari Miklat, you know, we know the famous Gemara in Makos describes how the mothers of the Kohen Gadol would bring all sorts of goodies and clothes to the Ari Miklat to actually butter up these murderers so they don't daven for their son to die, right, in order to get them out of there. And the obvious question is, you know, we have a Havamina that Hashem is going to listen to the tefilos of this rotzeach, of these murderers, right, to such an extreme extent that Hashem would potentially kill the Kohen Gadol, the holiest man alive, as a result, right? You know, the Gemara's mashma that the mothers had to butter them up so they wouldn't pray for her son to die. It's mashma that if they did pray for her son to die, Hashem might kill him. How is that possible? The Kohen Gadol is the one of the greatest men alive, and these are basically their murderers. So how is that possible? How do you explain that Havamina? So the answer is yes. An amazing thing. The answer is yes, right? That a genuine, heartfelt tefillah is heard by Hashem, no matter whose mouth it comes from, right? That's why the tefillah of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, when davening for rain in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, v'lo sikanes lefanecha tefillas ovrei drachim. That's what the Kohen Gadol says. The travelers on the road don't want rain because it makes their trip burdensome with mud and it's hard to get around. And they daven to Hashem for sunny skies. So the Kohen Gadol davens that Hashem should disregard their tefillos because rain is critical for food and sustenance of the tzibor as a whole, right? A function overrides the personal troubles of the ovrei drachim. We have the same question. Hashem doesn't know that? That rain sustaining the entire Jewish people is more important than a few people who are, you know, have to step in mud, right? Well, why would he fulfill the tefillos of the Ovrei Drachim? What's the Havamina? And same Yisod. Because heartfelt tefillah is never ignored, regardless of where it comes from. And if the Ovrei Drachim have a real heartfelt tefillah that they have no one to turn to but Hashem, if the Rotzeach Beshogeg has a real heartfelt tefillah because he has no one to turn to but Hashem, it's possible that their tefillos might certainly be heard, and the Kohen Gadol might be in danger, and we might be in for a very sunny season without rain. So it's a very, important reality to chew on as it relates to all of us. Like when we daven three times a day. And we have to understand the unbelievable koach hatfila, mamish to move mountains, if we simply choose to take advantage of it. But all right, I digress. Back to our topic, the Ari Miklat, right? So that's the crux of the Ari Miklat. So interestingly, the Sfarim reference that six, the Ari Miklat, there were six cities, alludes to the six words of Shema, and 42 alludes to the 42 words of Hafta, the first Parsha of Shema. And the common lesson extracted by many from this is to teach us that for all of Klal Yisrael, our refuge, our Ari Miklat, can be found in Shema. And especially and specifically for those unintentional murderers, their protection from the Gaol Adam is rooted in Shema and V'ahavta. So what does that mean? That's a very, Bashamayim, lofty statement that the pnimius of Ari Miklat and its protective powers lies in the Parshios of Shema. How do we explain that? So the Chiddush Arim has a very, the first Gei Rebbe has a very famous Yesod about the function of the Ari Miklat and the accompanying drama of running away to one of them. And he says as follows. He says that when a person kills another person, right? We all know this to be true. If a person, chas v'shalom, actually kills another person, even if it's b'shogeg, it's unintentional. The crime is still so heinous that it destroys a person, right? This act, taking the life of another Jew, brings a Jew to a place where it's ke'ilu, he has no makom. He has no place in the world anymore, no place amongst civilized society, right? His very existence as a member of humanity has been drastically compromised. So he isn't killed. He isn't put to death by Beis Din because his act wasn't bemazed, but he can't stay in the civilized world anymore because he has no makom, right? An example of this is when Cain killed Hevel. What became of Cain? We all know what happened to Cain. He roamed the earth. And for this very reason, because his act of murder, ke'ilu, robbed him of all sense of makom, of a place. So therefore, dafka, for the unintentional murderer, in these psukim, they have no place, they have nowhere to go, so Hashem created Ari Miklat in order to tell this Jew who has no place in the world, come stay with me. I, Hashem, have a makom for you. Your place is here. So it's not just a practical thing to protect them from harm at the hands of the Gaol Adam. That's true. It is true. But it's much more than that, says the Chiddush Arim, that a person can be excluded from society because of what they did. That's true. But Hashem never throws someone away. Hashem never shuts the door, right? Hashem always leaves the lights on, kivyachol, in the Ari Miklat, says the Chiddush Arim. The lights are always on in the Ari Miklat. And yes, this pshat is talking about murderers. That's true, about someone who kills unintentionally, b'shogeg. But I think the yesod applies to all of us who have hopefully never killed anyone, but averos can have a similar effect, right? A person is nichshol b'avera, whether society knows about it at large and it makes him a pariah, or even if it's a total secret to no one knows but him or her, it doesn't really matter. When a Jew messes up, when we all inevitably mess up from time to time to some degree, we lose our makom, we lose our sense of belonging to the Am Segula Mikol Amim, we lose our sense of entitlement to be a card-carrying member of the Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. It tears us up inside when we do an Avera. It embarrasses us. Or at least it should. That's a whole other conversation we discussed last week, the virtue of hatred and its inherent value in combating taiva and averos. But the point is that our failures in life do and should haunt us and cause us to fear the Gol Hadam of those averos, of those shortcomings. In this case, that would be the kategor, the prosecutor in Shemayim that we speak about on the Yom Narayim, who keeps tabs on the goings on in our lives. That should cause us a sense of fear. But the chizuk of the Ari Miklat is that for that Jew who does feel that fear and that sense of loss, Hashem never closes the door. The Ari Miklat are always open for that Jew in the form of Torah, in the form of mitzvos, in the form of Maisim Tovim. Those are the Ari Miklat of today in our lives, right? And by fully immersing in those holy things, that can provide a rehabilitation and resuscitation for whatever a Jew did. Even if it's just, he says, the Chiddush Arim says, even if it's just a psia achas, a small step in that direction, just like a psia achas outside, if he takes one step outside the Ari Miklat, that's enough of a license for the Gol Hadam to kill him, so too a psia achas into the Ari Miklat, even a small step into the Ari Miklat of Torah and of mitzvos is enough for Hashem to warmly welcome that Jew in. And that's the pnimius of the Ari Miklat. And that's why the pnimius of the Ari Miklat is Shema. Because by immersing in Shema, in the oneness of Hashem, Hashem Echad, in the love of Hashem, V'yahavta, in the love of Torah and mitzvos, v'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol modecha, only there, the flawed, imperfect, guilty Jew, representative of really all of us, can only there they find refuge and peace from all uncertainty and all fear. So it behoove all of us greatly to think about this, to think about this long and hard, especially with the Yom Neroyim. They're not that far away from now. We just entered the 9 days, so before you know it, we'll be talking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. This is Dafka, the essence of the Yom Neroyim. Right? We all are imperfect to varying degrees. We all are to some extent, we lose our makom over the course of the year. But on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we reaffirm our entry into the Ari Miklat, right? One small step at a time, one psia achas at a time. That's all Hashem wants, a psia achas. That's all He wants, a small step. And that's why some say that Sukkah, the concept of Sukkah, which comes after Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, is a reference to the Ari Miklat, right? In the aftermath of Yom Neroyim, Hashem is providing us with a new makom at His side. And Sukkah is that makom. So Mirat Hashem, we can derive chizik from this, right? This lesson of the Ari Miklat, to always be seeking ways to reconnect with Kedusha and Ruchnius and Hashem Himself. And in that pursuit, with that psia achas, we should be zocha the tremendous siyata d'shmaya to always find our way home. Finally tonight, so that's Matos and that's Maaseh. Those are the two parshas for this week. But finally, as we mentioned at the outset, tonight is Rosh Chodesh Av, Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av. So I thought we'd end tonight with just a few short ideas of chizuk stemming from this unique tekufa of the year. So number one, many of the Mefarshim describe a play on words within our Parsha, in Parsha's Maaseh, that allude to an Eitzah, a piece of advice for this time of the year. And I brought it here on the last page of the Maamar Komos. For those following along, I'll send that out as well with the WhatsApp in the WhatsApp group along with the actual recording. But I brought it here from the Ben Paras Yosef. But I've heard it in the name of the Chasam Sofer and many others. That the Pasuk says in Maaseh, when delineating all the different stops that Klal Yisrael made in their journey from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael, Vayis'u mecharada. Klal Yisrael left charada. Right? Charada in Lashon HaKodesh means fear. Right, the pasuk says, "Vayecharad Yitzchak charada gedola." When Yitzchak realized that Yaakov had tricked him into getting Esav's bracha, that Yaakov got the bracha instead of Esav, so it says Yitzchak feared. "Vayecharad Yitzchak charada gedola." So Klal Yisrael, "Vayisu mecharada," they left fear, and then "Vayachanu b'makelos." Makelos is from the lashon of kehila, a tzibor, a community. So says the Ben Paras Yosef and many others. That this time of the year, the 3 weeks, the 9 days, are a time of charada, a time of fear, of sadness, of anxiety. So how do we move away from that? How are we vayis'u mecharada? Very simple. By immersing and encamping ourselves in the kehila, vayachanu b'makelos, to the maximum extent possible. Achtus, unity, is the tikkun, like we mentioned, like Aaron HaKohen, who's oev shalom v'rodev shalom. It's the same idea. Achtus, unity, is the tikkun, is the rectification to all the ills of the 3 weeks and the 9 days. Right? If we're camped, rooted firmly in Achtus, in Makelos, then we are long gone from Charada. However, Vayisumi Makelos, if we don't take this advice, if we ignore this Eitzah, and we leave the safety of the Kehila, Vayisubi Makelos, we leave Makelos, if we don't immerse ourselves in unity and Achtus with our fellow Jews, and instead we go the other way, we journey towards Sinas Chinam and disharmony, then where do we end up? Vayachanu B'tachas. Right? Then Lo Aleinu, we end up encamped at Tachas, at rock bottom, Tachas. And chas v'shalom for any of us to ever see that place, that terrible place. So this is a subtle but very powerful lesson from our parsha about the tafkid and the mindset for all of us to embody. Achdus, unity, kehila, to always be that type of a Jew, but especially during this time of the year. That's number one. Number two, Rav Gedalia Shor, in Or Gedalio, in the Likutim on Parshas Maaseh, quotes the pasuk that we read in the very beginning of Eicha. I think it's the third pasuk of Eicha. We say Kol Rotfei Yisigua Bein HaMitzarim, literally translated as all the Kol Rotfei, the pursuers of Yerushalayim, overtook the city, Bein HaMitzarim, between the boundaries. But the Or Gedalia reads it Bederech Drush, Bederech Remez, right? He says, Kol Rodfea means, is really Kol Rodef Hashem, Ka, Kol Rodef Ka, that whoever is seeking Hashem, whoever is chasing after Hashem, Hainu She Rodef Achar Hasagas Hizgalos Hashem, whoever is chasing after a relationship with Hashem, Yachol Hisigua is Hasaga, Hisigua is Yachol Hasigo, where? Bein HaMitzarim. Right? In other words, for those who are seeking Hashem, for those who are genuinely seeking Hashem's presence and the maintenance of a relationship with Hashem, now is the time. Right? In this Zman, in Bein HaMetzarim, of the three, in this Zman of during the 3 weeks, Dafka now is where you can find a Hashem. Why now? That's the question. Why now? What's so special about the 3 weeks, about Bein HaMitzarim, that Hashem is more available to us, right? Yachol Hasigo Bein HaMitzarim. Hashem is more available to us at this time during the 3 weeks, the 9 days. Why is that so? So he gives a mashal, or Shor gives a mashal to a king, that when he's at home, and he's in the palace, if he's in the White House, it's very hard to access him, right? You need an appointment. He's behind all the various layers of security. You got to go through everything. But when he's traveling, when he's on the road, it's exponentially easier to gain access to the king, even for a simple person who normally would never get access to the palace. And so too, during the year, Hashem is in his palace all the time. So our tefillos have to go through all sorts of background checks and secret service protocol to get to the Kisei HaKavod. But during the 3 weeks, says the Or Gedalia, Shegolsa HaShechina Mimkoma, the Shechina is on the road, Kivyachal. Hashem is in Golus from his normal dwelling place, for the wrong reasons, of course, right? This isn't a happy vacation. It's Golus. But nonetheless, since Hashem is in transit, however tragic that may be, the silver lining is that it's exponentially easier to get a few words in, right? Kol rodev ka, whoever is seeking Hashem, hainu shirodev achar hasagas his galus Hashem, right? Kol rodfeh hisigua bein hamitzarim, yachol lasigo bein hamitzarim. Hashem can be found in the 3 weeks, in the 9 days, because he is among us. He is traveling. He's available to be spoken to. Therefore, this period of sadness and tragedy actually is really an unbelievable Eis Ratzon. So Mirtz Hashem, we can be mechazek ourselves in this and make sure, you know, we use this time of the 9 days and Bein HaMitzarim, when Hashem is closer to us than practically any time of the rest of the year, to take this advice, to get those words in, to get those tefillos in, to make sure that the relationship is firm and solid and genuine. And if we can do that, you know, in Mirtz Hashem, that is the first and the most important step to turn and uproot this period of Bein HaMitzarim on its head, right? From Churban and Golos to Yeshuos and Nechamos and Simcha with the coming of Mashiach b'mehera v'yameinu. And with that, I wish everyone a wonderful, beautiful Shabbos and a very good Chodesh.